From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a kind of trench warfare now over the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. spent years negotiating it. The president says it's basically the deal or war. Opponents say it's not good enough. Israel's prime minister says it's a disaster. Now everyone's battling for votes in Congress to kill it or save it. The lobbying and arm-twisting and jawboning is intense. This hour On Point, the battle to kill or save the Iran nuclear deal. Joining me first today from Washington is Jody Schneider, congressional editor for Bloomberg News, where she oversees coverage of the Iran deal. She's been counting votes on where this is headed. Jody Schneider, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
All of the battling over this boils down to a vote. When is that likely to happen, and what does it look like now in terms of whether President Obama will have a sustainable veto here?
Well, lawmakers have until the end of the day, September 17th, to complete their review of the deal. They passed legislation and sought legislation to be able to review the deal, and that's the time frame. In the Senate, 24 of 44 Democrats, including Minority Leader Harry Reid, have not yet announced how they'll vote on the Iran accord, though just one, Charles Schumer, has come out in said he'll vote against it. So the Democrats there are, you know, we're still waiting to hear from a number of them. Senator Menendez of New Jersey said in the next day that he will announce, and he may very well say that he'll vote against the agreement because he has made some negative comments on it in the past. In the House, they already have more than the 218 votes they would need to pass what's called a resolution of disapproval of the accord. So the House is pretty much, that is pretty much for certain that they're going to disapprove it. The Senate, they still need, they will still need some Democrats along with Senator Schumer to go along with the Republicans in order for disapproval there. If that happens, then, of course, the president has said he will veto it, and it does not at this point look like there are enough votes to override a veto, but that the campaign that you mentioned, this very intense lobbying campaign on both fronts, is being made not only for this resolution of disapproval, but for the veto override vote as well.
Can we just walk back?
There will be intense lobbying.
Can we walk back through that one more time, Jody? Let's just take the House first. So you're saying in the House, where Republicans are pretty much, I guess, is unanimous the right word, in opposition to the deal, and enough Democrats are that it is now a given that there will be a resolution rejecting the deal in the House?
In the House, there's enough votes for it right now, yes.
But the president, if he can sustain a third of the House membership, if he would then veto what he needs, a third of those votes to sustain his veto, how does that look?
Well, the veto override will be tough. It's a much harder climb, as you say. You need two-thirds, and that doesn't look likely. And at that point, Nancy Pelosi and the House leadership, the Democratic leadership, will lobby very hard. In the Senate, it's the same thing. Even if you get a resolution of disapproval, it will be very hard to override that promised veto. The president has pledged he will veto that. Legislation disapproving of it.
Is there an informal headcount underway now in the Senate? And what does that suggest about how many votes might actually be in play here? It's unlikely, but if we're talking sort of, you know, yard by yard, inch by inch lobbying here to get votes, is there a scenario in which the opponents of the deal could stack up the votes to override the president's veto in the Senate?
There's a scenario, but it's hard to see. It's a very difficult path. The president basically, he would need 34 votes in the Senate and 145 votes in the House to prevent an override. So you have basically enough votes from the Democrats, of all the Democrats, and at this point, well, even losing Schumer and even losing Menendez, if that's the case, you would still have plenty to sustain his veto. So you would need Democrats who may have have some opposition, but they weren't going along with that initially, to change their votes, and that's very hard to do.
We're talking
to see how you get there.
We're talking about many millions being poured into this lobbying campaign on both sides, but certainly perhaps in greater volume than reporting would suggest, on the push to override it. That, is that being spent? I mean, surely people would actually like to kill the deal if they're spending that much money and putting this much on the line. Or is it, is the resolution of rejection enough for some of those parties?
Well, that's a, that's an interesting question, and it's tough to see, you know, this when you ask people who are spending this kind of money, they're saying, well, you know, obviously we want to see this deal killed, and on the other side, obviously they're saying, well, it's very important that this deal go through. But some of this is obviously with 2016 campaigns, and not just the presidential, but the Senate and House campaigns, not that far away. A lot of this is being done for that as well, and these votes and the votes that people will take on this in both chambers can be used against them by their opponents as well. So I think that's part of the lobbying. This is message lobbying as well as lobbying on the actual deal.
Jody, we're moving past the middle of August here. When is it expected that these remaining unconfirmed members of Congress will come forward with their positions, or might they not until the day of the vote?
We are expecting some of these when Congress is actually out. Labor Day is late this year, so Congress is not back in town until September 8th. And so that's, you know, only, what, 9 days before they actually have to vote on this. We are expecting to see more of those undecideds or unannounced. Who knows if they've decided, but they will be, we're expecting a lot of them to be making their announcements right when they come back, and some probably will in the end of August. They've been trickling in little by little. Yesterday, we heard from Senator Bob Corker, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he said he opposes the deal, which we, you know, was not a surprise, but he wanted to, you know, make his statement. And I think given that, we'll see others come in. So it's intense on both sides, and it's not just the ads that you mentioned, but a lot of this is getting is very direct lobbying. AIPAC and the Israel lobby is they've brought people over to Israel. They've brought lawmakers over to Israel. You're seeing the use of, you know, very direct kinds of appeals. Most lawmakers in both chambers have met with AIPAC, and I think there's a lot of. And then on the other side, there's very direct lobbying as well. So I think a lot of these appeals are being made on a very personal level, and the president is doing that as well. He is making phone calls from vacation.
Jody Schneider covers all of this for Bloomberg News on Capitol Hill. Jody, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The president speaking about this early in the month at American University in Washington talked about the big effort being poured into lobbying over the Iran nuclear deal. Here's President Obama.
Between now and the congressional vote in September, you are going to hear a lot of arguments against this deal, backed by tens of millions of dollars in advertising. And if the rhetoric in these ads and the accompanying commentary sounds familiar, it should. For many of the same people who argued for the war in Iraq are now making the case against the Iran nuclear deal.
The president at American University, that was loaded and intended to be to remind Americans of the Iraq war. He got heat from some, saying, hey, that's anti-Semitic right there. The pressure is high. The president dialing congressmen and senators here and congresspeople all over the place, even on vacation. Catherine Ho is with us right now from Washington. She covers lobbying at The Washington Post. She's been writing about the lobbying groups and money behind the Iran deal, push for and against. Mega donors opposing Iran deal have upper hand in fierce lobbying battle is the headline on her latest piece. Catherine Ho, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What kind of resources are being brought to bear in this fight?
Well, as you and Jody both mentioned, there's a lot of money being spent on both sides. In my story, we did a little bit of digging into some of the foundations of a lot of these wealthy donors, and we found that a small handful of them are giving a lot of money, about $13 million when you add it all up, to groups opposing the deal. And those donors are Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer, and Haim Saban, who, interesting enough, they give to politicians on both sides of the aisle. But their foundations have given a lot of money over the past 5 years to groups that are now opposing the deal.
A total of $13 million you found there. Is that up to date? Because we're reading something like $30, $40 million on an ad campaign there. $13 million doesn't come close to that.
Right. So the $20 to $40 million that Citizens for Nuclear Free Iran says they're spending, that's money that they say they have now and will spend now, probably before September, because that's when the vote is. The money that we looked at, we had to go back a few years because the most current tax filings, which is what we looked at, are from we set a time frame of 2010 to 2013 because that was the most recent we could find. So there is a time lag. You know, we can't say for sure that the money that these donors gave are now being used on this Iran deal because obviously the Iran deal didn't come about until this year. But I think it is interesting to see where these groups have gotten their money before in the past.
So it's indicative more than precise right now. What about there is also money being spent on ads by supporters of the deal? Ads and more. What does that add up to? You said $13 million was your tabulation for the portion of time you could look at. What about on the other side, the pro-deal side?
Sure. On the other side, it's a lot less is what we found. It's in the hundreds of thousands, which is, you know, nothing to sniff at, but it's certainly not $13 million. And in that case, we found George Soros has supported J Street, for example, in the past. And there are also a couple other foundations that have supported the pro-deal side, and they include Plowshares, which is a non-proliferation foundation. They support a lot of organizations, and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund.
We want to come back and dig on into those numbers and the lobbying efforts on all sides of the Iran nuclear deal. Catherine Ho at the Washington Post, please stand by there in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great battle going on right now over the Iran nuclear deal, the intense lobbying, the pressure, the money, the interest, the arguments being brought to bear on members of Congress in the House and the Senate. By September 17th, they will vote up or down. If they vote it down, the president is pretty clear. He will veto, and then can that veto be overridden by Congress? That is where the rub is likely to come. Here's a little bit from one of the ads that are out there. Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran, group supported by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, posted this ad denouncing the deal the week after it was announced. The ad is part of as much as $40 million campaign running in maybe 35 states to oppose the agreement.
The Iran nuclear deal. Good deal or bad deal? Iran keeps their nuclear facilities. Military sites can go uninspected. Restrictions end after 10 years. Then Iran could build a nuclear weapon in 2 months. Iran has violated 20 international agreements and is the leading state sponsor of terrorism. Congress should reject a bad deal. We need a better deal.
If your senator is on the fence, you may be hearing or seeing that ad on TV. It's not the only one. The liberal Jewish Middle East lobby J Street has also announced a multi-million dollar campaign, smaller but nevertheless, to support the Iran nuclear agreement. Here's one of J Street's ads in support.
When he negotiated a nuclear deal with the Soviet Union, Ronald Reagan said, "Trust but verify." We don't need to trust Iran to honor a nuclear agreement. This deal mandates the toughest inspection program in history, putting inspectors on the ground and electronic monitors at all Iranian nuclear sites. Most important, this deal prevents Iran from producing a nuclear weapon. It's good for America, good for Israel, and makes both countries safer and more secure.
That from J Street. Catherine Ho's reporting on the money behind all of this. She joins us from Washington and the Washington Post. Where are these ads dropping with the most play, Catherine? Have you tracked that at all? Are these being targeted at senators who are unannounced or on the fence?
They are. A lot of them are running in Maryland, which is the home state of Ben Cardin. He's a Democratic senator who's undecided on the deal. He says he'll probably
come out. Ranking
member
of the Foreign Relations Committee.
That's right. He said he'll probably come out with a decision publicly after Labor Day. And so he's seen as a very important vote on this issue because of his standing on the Foreign Relations Committee. So that will be a very important vote. And so a lot of the ads, at least on television, have been airing in Maryland. There are also a lot of ads in Michigan and Colorado, and those are states where Democratic senators are also undecided.
Name them, which ones, or all of them?
Michael Bennett in Colorado, Debbie Stabenow in Michigan.
We saw Jeff Flake over the weekend, Republican, come out in opposition. Was that really in question?
That's a good point. I think, you know, he was the only Republican who appeared open to it. But I don't think it was that shocking that he came out against it, given where the rest of his party stands.
And, of course, we had Chuck Schumer, who came out this time last week in opposition to the Iran nuclear deal, said the inspections regime baked into it just didn't cut it. Here he was.
I found the inspections regime not anywhere, anytime, but with lots of holes in it. Particularly troublesome, you have to wait 24 days before you can inspect. That will allow some of the radioactivity to be seen, but not non-radioactivity that goes into building a bomb.
Senator Chuck Schumer, no, he says. He cannot, will not support the Iran deal. Catherine Ho, you've gone sort of through this group by group. Let's look first at the opposition and where you found the biggest money moving in opposing the Iran nuclear deal. What groups?
Citizens, which is the APEC-backed group, I would say they're one of the leading voices, at least in terms of the amount of money they're spending. There are also several others. The Israel Project is one of them. United Against Nuclear Iran is another group. The Israeli American Council has also come out against it.
The United Against Nuclear Iran has an interesting story. Joe Lieberman just took over as chairman there, and their president has left. Gary Seymour, what was all that about?
So Gary Seymour left late last week because he looked over the deal and decided he supports it, but the group itself does not. And so he stepped down because it would be, a conflict of interest if the head of a group that opposes the deal supports the deal. And so the same day, that group named Joe Lieberman as the head. And Joe Lieberman is kind of an interesting character in all this because he actually sits on the board of advisors or the board of directors for three of the groups that are opposing the deal.
Isn't it kind of weird that the head of United Against Nuclear Iran would step down over? Explain that to us. He had a background in nuclear oversight, didn't he? Of some kind with Bill Clinton?
He did. He was an advisor on these issues to Clinton. Excuse me. So yes, it is very strange that he stepped down, and that was very closely watched by, especially a lot of the foreign policy experts. You know, it's a kind of a small circle of folks here in Washington who watch these issues very closely. And that was a very big deal.
But this group was formed to try and keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And its president now leaving as Lieberman takes over. But the outgoing president saying he's for the deal.
Right.
What about on the support side? What are the groups there that you've found money flowing through and for?
J Street is probably the biggest one. They've raised about $5 million in the past month or so since the deal was announced. And while, you know, that figure is not close to $20 or $40 million, it's still, quite a bit of money that they're now spending, mostly on paid advertising, full-page ads in the New York Times. They're also doing some TV ads. They've also brought over quite a few Israeli military officials to meet with editorial boards and newspapers to try to sell their position in support of this deal.
The National Iranian American Council also in there. This is small money by comparison, but in there.
Right.
And Global Zero, there's Plowshares. What is this group? Who is this group? What's their agenda? They're also working very hard on the support side.
Right. So they support basically peace efforts, non-proliferation group. So they give a lot of money to various nonprofits that they see as supporting diplomacy or supporting peace efforts.
$11 million, I'm reading here, spent over the last 6 years advocating for a nuclear deal with Iran. So when we see these groups coming out, whether recently there was a big batch of generals and admirals that came out with a letter in support of the deal. There was a big batch of nuclear physicists. Are those spontaneous or are those being orchestrated? And if so, by whom? By Plowshares?
That's a good question. The nuclear physicist's letter was written to the White House last week. And, it's not clear how exactly that came about. But I think that is something that is certainly good for the White House to cite. These are the world's foremost experts on nuclear weapons. And they endorse
this agreement. So that's certainly something that the White House can point to and say, you know, we got the endorsement of nuclear physicists who, you know, this is their area of expertise. So that I would say that bodes well for the White House, which has been doing a lot of lobbying of their own.
Everybody's looking for validators here. We've also got a new veterans group set up in opposition to this. Hard to trace some of the support for some of these groups. Others, not so difficult. When you speak with groups that are opposed to the Iran nuclear deal, Catherine Ho, do you have the sense that they are have a hope of actually killing it? I mean, they're putting a lot of money and a lot of effort into this right now. We heard Jody Schneider at Bloomberg say, I heard her saying she doesn't think that they can get the votes in the end to override a presidential veto. What are you hearing?
I mean, they're very steadfast in their belief, and they've got the money to spend. So I think, you know, yes, it's unlikely, as Jody mentioned, because the votes, you know, 2/3 is a very high bar. But they're really going at it, and they have a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of resources. So I think it'll be very interesting to see how this all plays out.
Catherine Ho has been covering all of this for The Washington Post. Catherine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've got opponents and supporters all over the place. The most prominent opponent, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On August 4th, he spoke via a webcast to some 16,000 viewers, a webcast sponsored by Jewish federations across America, targeted to the American Jewish community. Here he explained in that webcast his opposition to the Iran nuclear accord, emphasizing the direct threat that he said Iran poses to Israel.
It's we who are on the front lines. We face Iran's terror on three borders. We face tens of thousands of Iranian rockets aimed at all our cities. We face Iran, whose regime repeatedly calls for the destruction of the Jewish state. We face Iran, whose terrorist proxies try to kill Jews every day. We know that Iran is not only the leading state sponsor of terrorism, it's also the leading state sponsor of anti-Semitism. Israelis are going to be the ones who pay the highest price if there's war and if Iran gets the bomb.
There, the Israeli Prime Minister speaking directly to an audience inside the United States. With us right now from Westport, Massachusetts, Nicholas Burns, Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He was the lead on U.S.-Iran policy. Nicholas Burns, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from New York is J.J. Goldberg, editor-at-large at The Forward, a newspaper that focuses on Jewish issues. We've been paying a lot of attention to the arguments and efforts around the Iran nuclear deal. J.J. Goldberg, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Tom.
Nicholas Burns, first to you. What do you see playing out in this ardent support and opposition? What are the worldviews or maybe just that are clashing here?
Well, I think what's clashing, Tom, is there's agreement, I think, across the board among Democrats and Republicans, and I've testified four times in the last 30 days, so I think so I've got a good sense of what Congress is thinking, agreement that we have to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear weapons power. There's disagreement on how to do it, and I think President Obama has been saying, we've been in negotiations for 2 years, we have this agreement, the best way forward is to implement it, because as he says, it'll freeze the Iranian program for the next 10 or 15 years. And we'll be the better off for that. He also is saying that if the Iranians violate this agreement and drive towards a nuclear weapon in the future, his successor or successors as the American president will be able to stop them through the use of military force. So it's an argument for diplomacy versus whether we should go into a more confrontational stance towards Iran or even fight Iran over nuclear weapons.
When the president says, it, more or less, it's this or war, does that sound overwrought to you or realistic?
It's not realistic to me. I support this deal, but I don't think it's inevitable if somehow the deal doesn't go forward, we'll end up in a war with Iran. I think it was ill-advised for the president to say that in the American University speech, and you played a clip of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's much more likely if Congress was able to override the president's veto. I do not think that will happen, but let's say it did, and the United States had to walk away from the deal. The Iranians would be unfettered, they would be strengthened, but I think they wouldn't make the mistake of going right up to the line to become a nuclear weapons power, because that would invite an attack by the United States or by Israel. I think they're too smart to play that game.
So you're saying it wouldn't go to war because the Iranians would be too fearful of war with the United States?
I think that's right. It's highly probable that you go back into the situation we've been in for the last couple of years. And as we looked at these, I served in the Bush administration as a career diplomat. As we looked at this problem back in 2005 and 2006, the Bush administration decided that we would try diplomacy with Iran because we didn't think, well, we thought there were a lot of risk with the possibility of warfare. And the law of unintended consequences, once you start a war, once you start a military campaign, as Churchill said, not always clear where you end up and how that ends up.
J.J. Goldberg in New York at The Forward, you've been writing a lot about the lobbying. Israel, right in the middle of this with Benjamin Netanyahu coming right into Congress, of course, earlier this year. And now a big campaign or campaigns geared up on both sides of this. But certainly, Netanyahu is still speaking very strongly against this. The Israeli ambassador in the thick of this, talking with lots of people on Capitol Hill. Your latest headline that I see here, JJ, how anti-Obama zealots went off the rails on the Iran deal. What do you mean?
Well, there is an effort at this point to portray the support for the deal as anti-Semitic. The idea that the Prime Minister of Israel has put out that if Iran, if this deal goes through, Iran will get nuclear weapons and will use them to exterminate the Jews of Israel. That's the vision that's being put out. I think a lot of people recognize it as overwrought and extreme. But there's a sense that you don't speak out against the Prime Minister of Israel. And so this notion of anti-Semitism, when the president said on Jon Stewart, if people speak out, Congress will listen, and this goes for any issue. I think he said every issue. If you express yourselves, you can be heard even over the lobbyists and the big money. And so there's this notion that when he said lobbyists and big money, he was using what they call dog whistles, code words, for Jewish influence, and therefore he's trying to stir up anti-Semitism. I don't think that's the issue. I think that people who are accused of anti-Semitism find it deeply offensive. There's a sense, I think, that when you if you perceive anti-Semitism, you say something. And the idea that calling someone an anti-Semite can itself be a slur doesn't occur to people. And so you've got this community with a lot of respect, with a lot of moral credibility over the last two generations in this country, speaking out sounds like as one because the other side is barely heard, saying our very existence is at stake, and it's pushing the credibility of the community, I think, past the breaking point.
The credibility past the breaking point. Of course, you've got American Jews coming down on all sides of this, but you're saying the impression is that it's on one side somehow.
The J Street has been pretty well, I guess, demonized over the last couple of years. They are not a major force in the Jewish community, even though there's a lot of people who have their doubts about the policy of the Likud government. They're not well organized. They're not well mobilized. The Jewish federations, that is the community chests of the Jewish communities around the country, are lining up one after another against the deal.
J.J. Goldberg, please stand by there at The Forward in New York. Nicholas Burns, a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. We're talking about the great battle going on right now over the Iran nuclear deal. Listeners, we will turn to you. What do you see unfolding here? What do you want? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the great battle going on right now over the Iran nuclear deal, the intense lobbying, the pressure, the money, the interest, the arguments,
President Obama speaking at American University earlier this month, saying there could be real grave consequences if Congress should reject it.
This deal is not just the best choice among alternatives. This is the strongest non-proliferation agreement ever negotiated. And because this is such a strong deal, every nation in the world that has commented publicly, with the exception of the Israeli government, has expressed support.
The president reportedly on the phone from his vacation on Martha's Vineyard, twisting arms right now to keep that core of support strong enough to withstand a challenge to his veto. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, again from the webcast that we cited earlier here, explaining his opposition to the nuclear accord.
The nuclear deal with Iran doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb. It actually paves Iran's path to the bomb. Worse, it gives Iran two paths to the bomb. Iran can get to the bomb by keeping the deal, or Iran could get to the bomb by violating the deal.
Nicholas Burns, how unusual is it for the head of state of a foreign country, Israel in this case, to be so involved and engaged in a foreign policy decision like this in Washington?
Well, it is unusual. I can't remember the last time that a friendly country, a close friend of the United States, would in effect take such a prominent role inside the American political camp discussion about this.
Now, Churchill in World War II, Winston Churchill, I don't know.
Well, Churchill came to the United States at the end of 1941, early 42, to basically argue that we should go forward together in a united campaign. That is not what's happening now. And I think it's a dangerous moment for Israel. Now, it's absolutely understandable why Israel would be concerned about this, and they have a right. The Prime Minister has a right to his own view. But to come to the United States, as he did in the spring, to go into the well of the Senate and to give a speech to the Congress and to speak for the defeat of President Obama on this issue was unprecedented, I think very ill-advised for the Israeli government to do that.
I want to go to our listeners. Bill in Iowa City, Iowa. Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think this over-the-top demagoguery is actually hurting the case in the argument against the thing. When they accused President Obama and Secretary Kerry of taking Israel to the doors of the oven and comparing Neville Chamberlain with Hitler in 1938 is actually hurting their case. Americans know demagoguery. They're offended by it, and it destroys the credibility of their case. And the second point, it wasn't covered very much, but 3 weeks ago, 35 Democrats had all the ambassadors of the countries who agreed with the deal. And they all said, hey, America, you're on your own. We're not going to come back to the negotiating table. That horse has left the barn. Thanks, Tom.
Bill, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Burns, people are calling here for a better agreement, opponents of this deal. Is that out there as an option? The president says this is it. Could the U.S. somehow go back and do better?
Well, I agree with the president on this, Tom. What the opponents are saying, many of them, is if the United States walked away from the agreement, so withdrew from it unilaterally, continued to sanction Iran, and waited for a better deal, that we'd be in a better position. The problem with that is that the rest of the world would likely not walk away with us. So we'd be leaving this deal. The Iranians would have all the restrictions that have currently frozen their program lifted, so they'd be strengthened. We wouldn't be able to sanction Iran effectively globally because that sanction regime would begin to fall apart without the United States inside these negotiations. And I fear, actually, it would weaken the United States and would leave Iran in a stronger position. So I don't think that that's a credible alternative as someone who worked on this issue in the last decade. And I think that's President Obama's strongest suit here. He has been saying there's really no credible persuasive alternative to what I'm proposing, and I do think the critics are really left just complaining, but without being able to persuade the American people there's a better path here.
JJ, how do you interpret that? Do you agree with Nicholas Burns? In which case, I guess you're both supporters of the Iran deal. If you don't agree, why are we in this position now?
Well, the opponents are saying, to be fair to them, that the United States has the strongest economy in the world. So even a unilateral set of American sanctions, if they remain in place, will force
companies, banks, and so on, oil companies around the world, to have to choose between, do you want to abandon the sanctions and go with the Iranian economy, or do you want to continue the sanctions and stick with the American economy? And that will, in effect, bring people back to the sanctions simply by the unilateral power of American dictate, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's widely accepted. And in fact, there is a growing sense in the Israeli military and intelligence establishment. There was 47, I believe, ex-generals who signed a letter about a week ago saying the Prime Minister should be working with the White House to develop next day planning, to refine open questions that remain in the deal: what constitutes a violation, what level of violation would require what level of response, and what would the response be, how can Israel's defense be strengthened in case things go wrong. The Prime Minister has refused to hear any of that discussion. He's forbidden the military and intelligence level that has ongoing contacts with its American counterparts to discuss these issues right now. And today, yesterday, he got a report from the Military Intelligence Corps saying, outlining the good and bad aspects of the deal. Now, giving the Prime Minister a formal document that includes the good aspects of the deal, the benefits of the deal, is a pretty major slap in the face. So the idea that rejecting the deal and moving forward can result in a stronger deal, I think the Prime Minister's position is getting weakened. The question is whether that will get out to the American public, or whether the Prime Minister will succeed in maintaining his image as the sole voice of Israel at this point.
Daniel in Tomo, Wisconsin. Daniel, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm actually an Israeli, and an Israeli, I can't understand why a deal like this, which it really has more holes than cheese, I'd characterize it, is becoming a political issue. Mr. Burns is saying that Prime Minister Netanyahu is being told by our military that there's good parts of the deal and he really should back down, he should try to cooperate. And that's really not true. That's not what's happening over there. Of course, there.
I think that was J.J. Goldberg saying the Israeli military and intelligence were briefing on along those lines.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It was Mr. Goldberg.
Yes.
There is some truth to that, but to say that his position is weakening is absolutely not the case. There's really wall-to-wall support against this deal in Israel. And it's not about politics. It shouldn't be about politics in Israel, and I don't think it should be about politics in America. It's about keeping terror from going nuclear. And I don't understand how President Obama and Secretary Kerry can be so patronizing as to tell Israel, now just settle down, kids. We know better. Just let us, we know your security better than you do. So from that position, I guess my plea to Congress and the American people is just to say no. Just say no.
Daniel, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Burns, is the U.S. patronizing Israel or the other way around? How do you see the dynamic?
No, I don't think that President Obama is doing that. I think there's a profound difference of opinion between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama, and there has been for 2 or 3 years, of how to handle this. And ultimately, the United States has to do what's in the interest of our country. And it's in the interest of our country to stop Iran. If we can do that through diplomacy, through this agreement, we're far better off than initiating a war. We always have the right and the option of going back to the use of force if Iran breaks the agreement and violates it in a fundamental way. But why is this important? Because we can stop their forward movement, the Iranian forward movement on the nuclear continuum. We can freeze them for 10 or 15 years, and we can impose the most intrusive inspection over the nuclear supply chain for the next 25 years. Tom, I see the risks here. And in my testimony to Congress,
mm-hmm.
I've told members there are benefits here and there are risks. And the risks are not inconsequential. But in my judgment, the benefits far outweigh the risks. We ought to go forward here. And I think the American Congress, many of these senators and members of the House feel this will be the most important vote they ever take. And I think they're right to feel that way, but it's disheartening to me and troubling that there's really no debate in the Republican Party. Nearly every Republican's going to vote against it. The real debate is in the Democratic Party, and that's where the president's fate in this deal rests as they prepare to disapprove his policy, and then he vetoes it.
Why no debate in the GOP? Is there a different strategic vision here?
Well, I wish that were the case. I have to say, as an outsider, I'm not a political person, it looks like just opposition to President Obama and his way forward, because it's hard to believe that in the House and Senate there are not three or four or five members in the Republican Party who might think this is a deal worth supporting. So it looks a lot like politics to me.
J.J. Goldberg, if Nicholas Burns looks at this and says, oh, okay, makes sense to go forward with this, but obviously the Israeli prime minister clearly does not think so. How do you interpret the difference in strategic view, worldview, outlook that produces that gap?
There is a political tradition that's very strong in Israel, and it's not unknown here, that if you speak loud enough, you speak strongly regardless of the size of your stick, the other side will back down because the force of moral argument. You're hearing people against the deal coming out and saying, don't you recognize evil when you see it? The idea of nuance, of complexity, offends some people. It gets beyond some people. It's a simple matter of right and wrong. That's a very popular view right now in the Republican Party. And I think Nick said that there must be four or five people on the Republican side in Congress who see the complexity of the issue and the advantage of trying out the diplomatic approach, given that it does, you know, you can always go back to the military. Once you have a leadership that is putting this in terms of good versus evil, of right versus wrong, with no complexity and no gray areas, it's very difficult to stand up. Malcolm Hoenlein, who's the head of the Conference of Presidents of Jewish Organizations, mm-hmm. once told me it's very hard to organize a march or rally that carries signs down the street saying things are complicated. And so to stand up in the face of that sort of argument and say, well, I know I'm a small minority, but I'd like to put in a good word for evil. It's a hard thing to do.
If you put it all in terms of good and evil. Sarah in Springfield, Illinois. Sarah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
When I listen to voices that I use as a reference, I think of my own experience living and working in Iran. I bargained for everything from potatoes in the market to Persian carpets. And bombastic tactics in that process were simply part of the deal. They were not necessarily views that were held in private.
But we're not talking about potatoes here, Sarah. We're talking about nuclear weapons. Do you mean you're willing to discount hot talk out of Tehran over the years?
Yes. And by the way, I am Jewish, and I was visiting a synagogue every single week when I was over there, different ones in the country, and there were people who spoke English fairly well in each of them, and I was listening to them. It's a style that we find extremely off-putting and scary, and I understand that. But I also found that it was simply a style. Ultimately, it was no problem to get a carpet or a potato because it was in their self-interest.
Sarah, I appreciate your call. Our time grows short here, and I'm sorry for that. But Nicholas Burns, the view of the world that you bring to this makes a big difference in where you come down. There's being a lot projected now through all this lobbying. Do you think the president can end up with a failed deal as you watch the dynamic that we're all watching?
I don't think so. I think certainly the Congress is going to vote to disapprove the president. The president will veto, but it does look like the Democrats have enough strength in the House, particularly in the Senate, to sustain the veto. And so the president will emerge, and this deal will go forward. And, Tom, I'd just like to say to the last caller, Sarah, I respectfully disagree. I think that the Israelis have every right to take these threats by Iran seriously. They have to. When the Iranians have been saying consistently Israel should be destroyed,
No other country in the world is saying that about Israel. So I sympathize with the position of the Israeli government. I just think in this instance that trying diplomacy before we leap into another big war in the Middle East, it makes practical sense to me. This deal can be successful, and if it's not, we always have the option that we're a stronger country than Iran. So that's why I support the president's nuclear deal.
JJ, we just got 20 seconds here. What about trying to kill this deal through lobbying and failing? What are the consequences of that for opponents?
If the lobbying fails and the deal goes through, the opponents have the satisfaction of knowing that they've wounded the president. Going into the 2016 elections, you've got a president who survived by one vote in the Senate and got his bare 34. There's a certain satisfaction and a certain political advantage to that.
One would not think that would be enough of a satisfaction, but it is on, and it's on at a big level right now. We'll watch it unfold in the weeks ahead. JJ Goldberg in New York at the Forward, thank you very much for being here. And Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State in the U.S. State Department, thank you, Nicholas.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.